Dargrave Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 4, delivered on June 12, 2014. The title of this lecture is Consumer Choice Theory.
Tonight, consumer choice and consumer rationality. To begin this lecture, I'm going to pretend that I didn't erase everything on the board, because there's a point that I want to make about demand and supply curves. In normal circumstances, and I've brought up some exceptions to that, demand curves slope downward. Now remember I mentioned that there are these goods called Giffen goods where the demand curve slopes upward. And we'll get back to that during this lecture, as a matter of fact. But mostly, for the most part, demand curves slope downward in quantity price space. And for the most part, except for a few interesting counterexamples, supply curves slope upward. The law of supply for supply curves and the law of demand for demand curves. And remember, there's no such thing as a law of supply and demand. No big thing. But we have some special versions of these curves that are important, actually. They apply to your lives. One of those is a the one I brought up about demand curves. Demand curves have a certain degree of price elasticity, steep versus shallow. Shallow curves are price elastic. Demand is price elastic if the curve is shallow, and the demand is price inelastic if the curve tends to be fairly steep. And the causes, and this is mostly just review, but it gets to some important points here in a minute. Demand in price inelastic. Okay, now demand would be price inelastic for things that are necessities. Doesn't matter if the price goes up, you're still going to buy a lot of it or buy some of it. For addictive goods, now also if there are no close substitutes. In other words, you can't jump away from this good and buy something else that's similar. And a couple of others. Demand curves tend to be price inelastic in the short run. Because people, essentially, they'll see a price jump and they'll still buy it until they decide that they can find something else or they don't need it. So in the short run, you'll tend to have price inelastic demand curves. And another one that makes demand curves price inelastic is if it's a small ticket item, some little thing that doesn't cost very much. People probably probably aren't going to react to rather significant price increases just because it didn't cost much to begin with, it doesn't cost much afterwards. Candy, things like that. For price elastic, of course, we would say instead of a necessity, it is discretionary. It's something that you don't have to have. It is non-addictive. There's nothing, you don't have a stake in this thing. many close substitutes. And I'll point out something right here. If there are, in a theoretical kind of way, an almost infinite number of substitutes, the demand curve will actually be flat facing a company. Great example of that is a grain farmer, because he can't distinguish his corn from any other farmer's corn, pretty much. Essentially, he's facing an infinitely elastic demand curve at some prevailing price at the farm level. He can't do anything about his price. It's essentially, he can sell as much of his grain as he wants at the mill's price, but that's it. So there are actual real examples of demand curves that are pretty much just flat, flat as hell. And also, demand curves tend to flatten out in the long run because people have more time to look for substitutes. They can spread the search cost out. They can just decide that they don't really need it anymore. And also, big ticket items tend to be more price elastic. This I bring up in marketing classes, this whole elasticity thing, for a couple of reasons, but one of them is this. One of the death traps of a company is what's called the sales addiction. When you start putting sales on your products because you know that consumers are price elastic, they'll respond to sales quickly. That what happens is you can't stop giving them sales. You're trapped forever in that death spiral. You have to do a sale all the time because you know that doing a sale is going to increase your business because the demand curve is price elastic. People will respond very strongly to a lower price. But then you start doing that, and then you have to keep doing it because your consumers expect it. Have you ever noticed how the car dealers constantly have some stupid deal? $500 off this car. $500 off if you come in before midnight. $500 off if you're not ugly. There are stores that actually get into this death trap, and then they try to get out of it, and they usually find out that's a disaster. A good example, do any of you ever shop at Kohl's? Have you ever noticed that they always have sale signs? Everything's usually on sale there. They tried for a while to break the cycle. They took down the sale signs, and they just put up a few new, completely different color, completely different type of sale. They tried to get their consumers weaned off. I go to Kohl's, and there's always a sale. Their sales went down dramatically. They turned into a bunch of poodles barking behind the sofa and put the signs back on their stuff. About a month after they started it. It just doesn't work. Once you have started giving those sales, you're stuck doing it forever on your stuff. That's why some store chains just won't get into it. Target, never got into that kind of trouble. They've suffered some setbacks, but they're essentially a very strong company. Walmart had a big problem with its price rollback gambit that it had done for years because the price rollback, essentially it wasn't working on the kinds of consumers that go there because the consumers who go there are buying things that are price inelastic to begin with, more necessities, the stuff of poor people that are price inelastic. So sales don't really matter too much to them. They're going to go to Walmart and buy their toilet paper, their booze, and their stuff like that one way or the other. It's a whole subject in marketing, and understanding it from a price elasticity point of view is worth considering if you ever even go into a business of your own. I'm going to show you the other side of this. And this is a side that impacts you personally. Because every one of you in here is a supplier. And I'm going to talk about supply curves for a minute. And as I said, every one of you in here is a supplier. You are probably, well, almost every one of you right now is a supplier. And the reason you're here is because you want to be better suppliers. And we'll talk about what that means here in a minute. But you supply. What do you supply?
What do I supply?
Yeah. Charm, good looks.
Code.
You are a supply of labor. You are part of the labor supply.
Fair enough.
You're part of the labor supply. Now, you've got to remember this because I always ask this question on the first exam, and I'll probably hit you with a quiz with it somewhere, but definitely on the first exam. Everyone can work stupid. Everyone on earth can be pure labor. Whether you are the dumbest person in Decatur, which is pretty hard to do in Decatur, or you are a PhD in quantum chromodynamics, you can all do donkey work. You can all pick up things, put them down. You can all work virtually as animals. And so we have this thing where a supply curve can be perfectly elastic if there are many, many, many suppliers of that product. In other words, this is the kind of supply that would be paid just a subsistence wage. Because if you don't want to do this kind of work, I can find a billion people who will do this kind of work. Because anyone can do this work. If you say, I want a raise, I can say, you need another job because I'm going to hire this guy. But I'm a coder, sir. Doesn't matter. You can still work this job as a donkey. You see, you might have aspirations and dreams. Your plan is to one day star in Terminator 7 as the Terminator, opposite Linda Hamilton and, never mind. Okay, I'm beginning to make myself choke. Okay, but you can still pick up those boxes and take them across the hall. You can still sweep the floor. It doesn't take any intelligence to do that. Not a bit of intelligence. Someone can go to Eureka College and still be able to do that. Ooh. Anyway. Now here, the price of labor is the wage rate. And the quantity is how many workers there are. And so at a subsistence wage, you can get anyone you want to do basic labor, which is why we want to bring you to college. You want to go to college so that you are no longer fireable if you don't take that stupid wage. In other words, you want to not only be part of this supply curve, but you want to participate in a supply curve that looks something like that, that has an upward slope to it. So as businesses want more of this kind of work, they have to offer a higher wage. So if they want a lot of these kind of workers, they're going to have to offer everyone who works at this job a darn fine wage. You say, well, would they have to offer everyone or just the last person? Well, if they offer the last person that wage and everyone else finds out about it, they'll just walk away and then they'll have to hire another person at that high wage. So you want to make it so that as businesses want more of these people, they have to pay a higher wage to all of those people. And the fewer of those people they can find that do that kind of work, the steeper the supply curve gets. So what you're trying to do is not just do something that's better than minimum wage. You're trying to do something where the businesses, the demanders of the product, can't find that many of those kind of people. So in other words, you want to find something that requires special skills, that requires skills that not everyone can get with just a high school education, skills that not just everyone can get with a community college education, skills that not just everyone can get with a bachelor's degree from a good school. You want to find, in other words, so if you major in, let's say, something that's easy, well, you're going to have a lot of people do that major too, and your supply curve is going to be a little bit upward sloping. Examples of that, easy degrees, sociology, marketing, education, elementary, special, and even secondary, education administration. Those were all easy, easy majors, even to the graduate level, and so you have a lot of people in them. You're not going to get much upward slope. That's why the wages suck in those professions. I tell my students in business, I say, how many of you are going to major in marketing? At their first day in my class as freshmen. Of course, you get more than half the class. Oh, yeah, I want to do that. I said, okay, for every 16 of you that graduate with a degree in marketing, there will be one job in marketing. Guess how much you're going to make and where you're going to work. That's right, you're going to make probably an average of about $24,000 a year, and you're going to work at S&K Men's Warehouse selling suits. If, however, you choose in business something like accounting or finance or operations and management, then you're slamming into majors that not everyone's going to do. If you're not in the College of Business, well, there are majors like engineering. Those are hard majors. Guess what? Not many people major in that, so you're going to have very steep supply curves. And the harder the major, the fewer the people who go into that, the more businesses are going to have to pay to get as many workers as they need. Healthcare is a field where there's a flood coming in now. And so guess what that flood's going to do? There weren't that many healthcare workers in about 20 years ago. And then the story started going that healthcare was the wave of the future. And so guess what's happening to the supply curve? It's flattening. We can see it. We're watching it happen. The same thing happened a generation ago with programming. Hardly any programmers in the 80s except us hackers, and we were writing code like a boss. And then, of course, oh, programming, computers, yeah, that's big stuff. So every son of a bitch and his mother went into the field, and the wages collapsed. They just spiraled downward. Well, I want to program games. You hear that one now. Oh, you sorry son of a bitch. No, you're not. You're going to work at McDonald's for the rest of your life with that major. Sorry, unless you have some awesome, really, really weird-ass talent. You're just going to be like anyone else who claims I can hack, I can write code. Who cares? So can everyone else, and so can a lot of computers write their own code now. Damn things. But once in a while, you see a supply curve that's really, really unusual. Okay, let me show you this one. A perfectly inelastic supply curve. A perfectly inelastic supply curve would be one where no matter how high the price goes, no more of it can come to the market. There's only a certain amount, and it cannot be reproduced. Picasso paintings would be an example. There was a fixed number of them. No more will ever be produced. A wine, Chateau Neuf de Derrière, 1947. There will never be a 1947 again. so that it's there's a fixed supply. No matter how high the price goes, there's a fixed supply. But this doesn't apply to just things. It applies to people. Okay, people, there are people who have a talent that just cannot be replaced. Go ahead.
Pavarotti.
There is never, again, going to be a Luciano Pavarotti. There are singers back in the day. Through time. A good example would have been a Streisand. When she was on her game, she could bring down curtains. Yeah. Any others? Any suggestions? Sinatra. There was just something about that damn man's voice. I heard him in his later years in Vegas. He was past his prime, but even then, I mean, he was just like, there's really something. I mean, Michael Jackson, back in the day when he was in his form, it was not just... there was the pyrotechnics, the choreography, and the whole stage. But it was all him. I mean, it all came down. It was just, wow, oh my God, whoa, geez. Oh. But there was still that small, scrawny man, young boy man there on the stage. And you just could not resist. You thought, this is like something I've never seen, and I'll never see this again. It was like some of those groups back before your time that I saw. Like, the Stones in their early days before they looked like old fossils. Floyd, Eagles. I mean, these guys were doing something that was just amazing. Beyond, no one else could dominate. I mean, my God, Freddie Mercury. I mean, good God. There was just something about these guys. And you just sat there. And, you know, and I am not really a fan of music. But I am a fan of this awesomeness of these people. And in this time, some of the people that you see in our time, there are a few singers who just cannot be replaced. I mean, there will never be another one like them in this time. I mean, you have the usual boy turds and slut girls that are on stage, and Nicki and, you know, Kesha and all that. But you have some that are more enduring, like... who's that one? Starts with a B. The Beyonce. Yeah, whatever. Or honest to God, one that she actually follows my work on Google Plus. Taylor Swift. She. There's something about her that's. You got to understand though, it's not her voice and it's not her music. It's her stage presence. If you stand on the side of the stage and you look at her, she has this presence and she just looks at you and then she looks back and she is just, that's what's drawing her. And that's what's drawing that little turd Justin Bieber. He's just a flash in the pan, but there's still something underneath him. And, you know, I can make jokes all day about Justin Bieber and I love to, but there is something there that's beyond, there is not another one of him, thank God. But at the same time, let's go to sports. Now, you better believe it. I mean, that's one of the few. Back in the day, I mean, you could lay down, name in the basketball arena. You know, you had Johnson, O'Neal, Bird. I mean, these guys in their time and in... I didn't say Jordan?
No.
I can't believe it. Well, that's because sometimes he sucked. But no, I mean, come on. No, honestly, though. And think about this. These guys, and if you ever saw Tiger Woods when he was in his day, now he's gone out of his day now, but in his day, there was nothing that could beat that son of a bitch. Back in the 1976 Olympics, something amazing happened in the gymnastics, which is grueling. Have any of you ever done gymnastics at any time? It's just a terribly hard thing. It damages your body. But there was, at the Olympics, this one little Romanian girl. And as soon as her performance started, I swear the whole world just stopped. And it was just beyond belief. And at the end of it, she spun off and dropped. And all, just right away, all of the judges, The first time in history, they all held up 10s. She was a perfect 10. There was nothing. They ran her routine in slow motion on TV sets around the world day in and day out. There was not a flaw in her routine. Never before had that happened. Okay, in acting. Why do these actors command the incredible prices that they command? Because there is nothing like them. Can you name an actor who commands as much as he wants for any movie he makes? Yeah, Cruise. Well, that's because he's such a creepy ass. Angelina Jolie, of course. But and who else? Who else? Sit, boy, down. Yeah. As a matter of fact, who's the one? Weirdo. Okay, but Liam Neeson would be one. He can command whatever he wants for a movie, and that's just it. And it's because they have something in them that is a combination of their talent and what the audience sees. Because remember, it doesn't matter. You can have an incredibly talented person, but if that person doesn't know how to bring the crowd and do something special, and that creates... You can't replace it. There's just not going to be anyone who does that particular thing. And that's why you see these actors, they try to carve out character sets. Directors do that too. A couple of the most successful directors, they are essentially in a way not replaceable. There's no one like them. Could you give me an example of a director?
Steven Spielberg.
Spielberg. Who else?
Howard. Ron Howard.
Ron Howard. Who else? Bay? Mm-hmm. How about who? Yes. Kagamusha was one of his, wasn't it? Never mind. Miyazaki, yes. Yes, it was. It was. Okay, another one would be Quentin Tarantino. He is phenomenal. I mean, yes, he understates. He goes too far in trying to downplay violence and gore. Sure. I watched his Kung Fu movie. A man's eyeball came flying past the screen and looked at the screen as it went by, for God's sake. But anyway, Tarantino, another one who is actually extraordinarily talented, although he pissed off reviewers about 10 years ago, so they keep trashing his movies, was M. Night Shyamalan. He has incredible movies, but the reviewers he made a mistake of pissing off reviewers some time back, so not so much so. But, okay, the point, though, is these are irreplaceable. They can command whatever they want for what they do in their arena and in the arena of business. There is no replacement for a Warren Buffett or a George Soros. There is no replacement for some of these other ones who play in that high-powered world. You would not know their names, but people will pay any amount of money to get their hands on these people. Lawyers. There are lawyers. You will not be convicted if you have the money to hire these lawyers. And so they can command whatever they want because there's no one like them in their business. So the bottom line is that whatever you're going to go into, ask yourself this. Is it something I like first? Okay, if then how many other people like this and are going to major in this? Because it's that second question that is going to drive how well you are going to do over time regarding your supply, being on a supply curve. And then ask yourself this. Is there anything you can do that is so special that no one else on earth can do it? If there is something like that, and you know how to play it right, you ought to consider doing that instead of your everyday thing in this life. That's all I have for you for this part of the lecture. Take a break. I begin the second part of this lecture tonight with an example of something here. I'm going to draw a demand curve for you. Here's a demand curve. And I'm going to look closely at this demand curve. I'm going to try to zoom in on this thing.
So let me take this little area right here. I'm going to draw a circle around the part that I'm going to zoom in on. It still looks like a demand curve. Not much there. There must be a lot of people in this market, a lot of consumers. Okay, well, we're going to try to zoom in again on a little area of the zoomed-in part, see what we can find. Still looks like a demand curve. Yeah, must be a lot of people in this market. Okay, well, let me do it again. I'm going to zoom way in with a super electron microscope. And, oh, finally. Now it's beginning to break down into people. You know what I just found? I found your ass! Yes, I did! I found your ass on this demand curve! Right there! Well, let me erase this before one of you sons of bitches takes a photograph of it and puts it up on Twitter. That's right! If I look closely enough at any demand curve, I will find your ass! Oh, shut up. I'm going to hell. Where the hell was I? Okay. I was right here going to hell. Okay, follow with me. You see, on a demand curve, there are people. It does represent something real, a willingness and ability of people to buy a product. Now, I'm going to show a supply and demand framework. Supply curve, demand curve. Here's the equilibrium price. Quantity and the equilibrium output, all that kind of stuff. And you're kind of getting used to seeing this thing. I mean, you ought to get a tattoo of this on your butt. This is the good stuff. But you see, I found you. Here's the price that the market is requesting. You can buy it at this price. But you see, I found you way up here. What that means is that you would have been willing and able to pay a much higher price than you really had to pay. Consumers have to pay this much. But all these people up here, they would have paid more if they'd had to. If you are in the desert dying, you'd pay a lot more for a bottle of water than a buck or $2. Do you wear underwear? I am so goddamn sorry I asked that. Because if you'd said yes, I would have said you will pay more. Weirdest ass, yeah. Let me make sure there's no deans out here. Okay. Okay, now, the point there being that for most people, they would pay more than they have to. Have you ever had one of those dreams where you were running around naked? So most people have one, and you'd pay money to have something to clothe those loins of yours. So the point being that many people will pay more for a good than they have to. We call that consumer surplus. People will pay more than they have to if things get bad. Now, I'm going to draw a real simple supply and demand kind of graph here to show this very clearly, what we're talking about with consumer surplus. This area from the demand curve down to the equilibrium price, that represents all of the people who would have paid more for a good or service than they had to. We call that, again, consumer surplus. And it is a very significant point that when we have this equilibrium price here, if we're letting markets discover their prices on their own in competitive markets, that area will be big, bigger than it would be if there were any other price. Now, on the other hand, if you look down here, this supply curve, there are many suppliers of this product who would have brought some of it to the market at lower prices. If you're a farmer who has a crop of corn and you could stay in business at $2 a bushel, but the grain mill says $3.30, you're not going to say, oh man, I wanted $2. I'm not going to sell it to you. No, you'll take the higher price. Woman, your first job pays you. Well, what do you think you're going to get for your first job? What's your salary about? No, I mean when you get your degree, let's say. Okay, you're going to run about, with your major around $75,000 a year. Okay? So, yeah, that's right. She's got one of those highly inelastic supply curves. Okay, 75. Now, you come to me, I'm the boss, and I say, oh, I'm going to pay you $125,000 a year. You going to say no? No, I wanted 75, sir. What the hell? No, you're going to supply at this better price, even though you would have been willing to deliver at a lower price. This is called, and all of these suppliers who would have sold at a lower price, but don't have to because the prevailing is higher, we call that all of what they earn between what they wanted and what they got, producer surplus. That's this area all through here, producer surplus. It's, again, a large area. Important point, and remember this for the quiz, for God's sake, that you got coming up after this class. I could not show you a market configuration that would create a larger total area than this. In other words, suppose that I were to draw that same supply and demand framework, but I imposed an effective price floor on this market. Okay? I imposed an effective price floor on this market. Let me finish drawing these up to the... Under these conditions, under that effective price floor, whoops, you get a very large producer surplus, okay? But look at your consumer surplus under that floor. The producer surplus is ridiculous under that floor, this vast area here. Now, suppose that I were to impose an effective price ceiling on this market. Lay the price ceiling here. Look at this massive
consumer surplus, but look how tiny the producer surplus becomes. It is only if you let the equilibrium price discover through the market mechanism that you get the largest area of both of them at the same time. That's one of the reasons we discourage price floors and price ceilings, because someone benefits, but at the cost of someone else. Later in this course, you're going to find out that when we let markets concentrate so that you have oligopolies or monopolies, that this problem starts to show up again, that the consumer surplus suffers at the benefit of the monopolist or the oligopolist. It's actually even worse than that. But if we have fully competitive markets and we let prices discover on their own through the market auctioning mechanism, we have the largest area of both of them at the same time, producer and consumer surplus. That subject, and I'll come back to this. I'm introducing it here, where you'll be receptive to the idea. So when I come back to it, when we get to the market structures like oligopolies and monopolies, you're going to see that there is a problem that goes beyond just bitching because the market is concentrated. It is a drain on the economy. Let me take this out of the realm of math and graphs just for a little bit here, and then we'll return to that here in a little while. In the first lecture, I brought it up, and I want to bring it up again more emphatically, that in economics, we assume that you are completely rational. You do what is in your self-interest, and you make the best decision possible. Do you have regrets?
Yes.
Do you have regrets?
Yes.
I have regrets. Most of them, they have the name of a girl or a dish at a Mexican restaurant. And then there was that Indian restaurant. You know, how spicy you want it? Zero through six. Six. I should have known when the chef and all the waiters were looking out at me as I started to eat the lamb curry. But anyway, there you go. Rationality, you say to yourself, well, that's a ridiculous assumption that we always make the best decision, the decision that is rational. Because we know that people are not rational. Actually, no, people are rational. What we also know is that their rationality is bounded by what they know. How much they know of the possibilities, the options available in any given situation, what they know about the risks that are involved. People don't have perfect information. No one does. And as you age, you're supposed to get a little smarter. That's why we will see people, well, you yell at the kid, your teenage son, that was a stupid decision you made. Well, actually, it wasn't irrational. He just did not have a good handle on the risks that were involved. The possibility that he would get in trouble or that he would lose a lot of money or something like that. People misassess risks. Most people, for example, buying lottery tickets is globally irrational. It is the stupidest ass thing you can do. And yet, people do it. Does that mean they're irrational? No. They have a misassessment of the risk involved in buying a lottery ticket. But they are not irrational. And in a way, here in economics, we are giving you credit. We are granting that you are intelligent
And the problem is that you just don't have all the information that you possibly could. There's another thing that bounds your rationality too. It's your tastes and preferences. You see, because sometimes we'll say, well, you're just crazy doing that. You're irrational. But not from that person's cultural perspective. Not from that person's upbringing, religious or otherwise. Ethnic, nationality. I've gone to places in the world where people eat things that I think, are you out of your frickin' mind? Have you ever heard of, I went to a sushi restaurant, a real sushi restaurant, not one of these phony things around this part. It was in Miami, where the first thing they served me was what's called a jumping salad. Have you ever, you know what a jumping salad is? It's a salad where the shrimp are in it jumping around. Yeah, and you grab them. And then they brought out some kind of an animal. They turned it inside out, stripped its guts out, threw the animal back in, and you ate the guts. The animal would grow new guts. Are you nuts? Are you on crack? What the hell? You know, eating live fish. These people do it. And you think to yourself, no, there is a place in Africa where the people, they kill a wild boar, and then they, to prepare the roast, they roll it in the boar's shit. They roll it in the shit. And then they roast it. Now, does that sound like a tasty dish to you? I guarantee you to them, that is culinary excellence. To you, not to me. You ever eaten fried scorpions? They're sort of like potato chips, crunchy. But most people wouldn't do it. But are they irrational for doing that? No, they are not irrational. That's just what they do. So in other words, this bounding of rationality is bounding that has also to do with the culture itself. And also the subculture. Within subcultures in the United States, things that are globally irrational are perfectly rational. And again, also the knowledge of the foreknowledge of risks. Unfortunately, in my business classes at Illinois State in the Business 100, I take those freshmen and the first thing I tell them is, if you start getting tats and gauges and piercings, I guarantee you, you are not going to get a job in the business world of any measure whatsoever. They tell me that all the time. I've had an executive of a company just 2 months ago grab me and pull me aside. What the hell did you do sending that girl up here with that piercing through her eyebrow? Don't ever do that again, or you won't have anyone come up here. I won't look at your people again. Ripped me up a new hole because of that. But for them, for these kids, it's rational. It's their culture. It's the thing. It's tats and all that. And the gauges. I mean, for God's sake, some of those. The ones that through your nose that make the cheeks. No. Anyway, look. But to the culture, the subculture of the kids, they don't see the risks. They don't see beyond the cultural standard that is theirs. So they're not irrational, but their rationality is bounded. And that's something that we have to remember whenever we do economics. You are rational. You're going to do what is in your self-interest, but your rationality is bounded. Bounded. It is not perfect. It can get better with education, with life experience, but I've met plenty of people, middle-aged and older, who were still doing stupid things long after they should have stopped doing them. Especially your parents, if you knew the things that they still probably do. Okay, that forms the basis of consumer choice theory. Consumer choice theory begins with the assumption. And I don't even like that word assumption. It's we're giving you the benefit of the doubt. We're saying you're rational. You just don't know everything that might be out there that you could know. Okay. Now we're going to do an experiment on you. I'm trying to look for someone. Okay, we're going to do this on you. Okay. You, woman, you're going to be my research assistant. We are going to find out how much joy is in this young man.
We have a joy meter, and we're going to attach it to his thigh. His smooth, very strong thigh. But young, quite young. He's 18. No, no. Now, what we're going to do is we are going to measure joy in this man as we apply a joyful thing to him. Indeed, we are going to feed him White Castle cheeseburgers. Now, at first, we calibrate the meter because he has had no White Castle cheeseburgers, so he has no joy. Meter is at zero. And so then I say to you, lab assistant, feed him a burger. And she packs it into his pie hole, and well, his cheeseburger hole. And and then we swallow it, good, measure. And you call out, the joy meter hit 100. Okay, now another. So you take another cheeseburger out of the cheeseburger bag, 30 in one of those cases. You can get 30 of them for a really attractive price. I always order extra onions because, you know, the gas and all that. Okay, second one. Two. Measurement, you call out 190. His joy is going up. This is his total joy. The meter was at 100. Now it's gone to 190. Okay, another three. Okay. Meter reading, 270. Four. Put another one in that pie hole. 340. Another one. Wait. Oh, God. I'm dying here. 400. Six. 450. Seven. 490. Eight. Dr. Kring, he's looking kind of green. Keep going. This is science. 520. Nine. And he goes 540. Hit him with 10. 550. 11. No change. Well, yeah, he's dead. The meter stuck. No, he detonated. Okay. What I've shown you is that, first of all, total joy has been going up. The total pleasure, as you get more and more of something, gets greater and greater. But something more important is going on. The extra joy. That's right, the margin. Notice that the first burger gave him 100 units of extra joy. But the second burger gave him 90 units. The third burger gave him 80, then 70, then 60, then 50, then 40, then 30, then 20, then 10, and then 0. What you're seeing here is a law of nature that goes far beyond economics and humans. It is called the law of diminishing marginal utility. We use the word utility because we're economists. We don't have joy in our lives. So in other words, when I say the word utility, think of pleasure or joy or happiness or yeehaw. This is a driving principle of nature that everything suffers this incremental, it gets more and more but it gets more and more at a slower and slower pace. And this is the basis of all marketing and, in general, business. These diminishing, these laws of diminishing. Joy. You find yourself, has this ever happened to you? You find yourself an incredibly hot wife.
Yes.
First time that night. Oh my God, incredible. Holy cow. Second time. Whoa. Fifth time. Oh, damn.
Yes.
20th time. No! Quit it! Get away! I can't pee. Go find a pizza. Come back in the morning. No, next week. Damn. Nothing you do stays as good as the first time you do it. You've used crack, cocaine. No, I just... That first huff, yeah. The time you get to the fourth or fifth one, ain't feeling nothing. Well, that's because you're dead, you son of a bitch. Anything you do is driven by this rule. I mean, do you like steak?
Oh, yes.
You know, I went to that place in Texas where they have a 5-pound steak. If you eat the whole thing,
it's free.
Better believe it. You know what? I did. It actually came out my ass a couple of years later, but I love that steak. I'm not joking when I say that was the best steak I had had in my life. It was so flavorful and it was tender. But I mean, by the time I got, it was like I was hitting a wall at about 3 pounds of it, and then I got this eater's high, and I cruised to the finish line, and I got slapped on the back by some Texas guys, and don't slap me, whap, whoa, you gotta hold it down, son. Okay, we're good. No, but you see, no matter what you love, I mean, too much of it, and you're not going to love it as much. And that's one of the things about consumer choice theory that we know, is that people are going to not want to buy as much of a product as maybe we would like them to. And the reason they won't buy it is not because they don't need it or because they don't like it. It's because it's just not giving them enough pleasure, the last units that we want them to buy. So the way we deal with that is we know that there's another factor involved. It's the price of the product. Because even if the marginal utility is down, way down, if we can drop the price, then the marginal utility relative to the price can go back up. I'll show you that a little more, but I'm trying to get kind of the common sense of this. We also know another thing. If you don't want to like something as much, you should buy more of it. If you want to like something more, you should have less of it. Don't forget that, because if you remember that, something that confuses the hell out of people with what I show in the next little thing right now, it'll confuse you terribly, but if you remember that the less you have of something, the more you enjoy it. The more you have of something, the less you enjoy it. What we know about consumers is that they have all these choices, but they are limited by their income. So we want to know, how do people make their choices of how much they buy of this, how much they buy of that? So, we've got to figure out what's driving it. We know that the marginal utility is driving it. Well, it's hard to measure this utility thing, that meter. We've actually tried things like that. Believe it or not, we've tried metering people. It's tough. But we do know that the theory is actually functioning in the real world. And we know that it's based on, first of all, not just the marginal utility of some product. Let's call it product A. It's based upon the marginal utility of that product scaled by the price of that product. We know that the price is in there too. So we say that what we're really looking at is not marginal utility on its own, but marginal utility divided by price. And what we know is this, that if you look at consumers and how they allocate their income, you've got a certain amount of money in your pocket, say, every week. We know that consumers are trying to pull off something close to this across their consumption. Say there were three products. We know that they're trying to make these as close, these marginal utilities scaled by price, as close to each other as they can. We've seen it over and over, and our marketing is based on this trick that we've seen in consumers over and over again. Now, they can't do it perfectly, but they're always trying to balance. So, in other words, if we saw, let's say a consumer had two things that he could buy with his income. One was A and one was B. And we look at them and we measure as closely as best we can. And we see that the consumer has gotten to a position where he bought some of each product, but the marginal utility of A divided by its price is less than the marginal utility of B divided by its price. So we watch, what does the consumer do the next time with this? Well, he's got to find a way to bring this up and this down. So what do you suppose we see the consumer do? Buy more of product A. Is that right? What happens if he buys more of it? What happens to his utility from the last unit? It would go down. He's going to try to bring this utility, marginal utility, upward. How is he going to make this product more valuable to him? By buying less of it. He needs to make this product's marginal utility go down. So he's going to buy less. Oh, I said that wrong. More of it. So let me do this with you. I'm going to give you this. And I want you to finish as much. We're going to do this together in class, as much of it, and then you turn it in next week. It should be a damn easy, free 10-point quiz for you. But we're going to work on it together here in class now and for the next 10, 15 minutes. And then you take it home, finish it up. If there's something you can't do, finish in class. But I want to make sure that I get you started so that you can get to the end of this on your own. Take just one. Don't be greedy. And you can work together. Don't be afraid to work together. And I'm going to be talking and walking around here while you do this. This is the best way in the world to teach this, is to just have you do a problem. We have food and drink. And do you see, first of all, are you okay with finding marginal utilities? You see what you do? Go ahead. Fill them out. The tables there, these are the same tables as these, except they got the extra rows in them. You see that? This is just this, and this is just this. So you just fill them out together. And go ahead, work together, for God's sake. These tables, this table, just this and this, so that you can fill in all these, okay? You follow that. This table is just that, and this table is just that one right there, with just some extra columns so that you can do some other work alongside it. And that, what you did there, is just that. These tables, this table is this one, this table is this one with some extra columns in it. Okay? And then you just put these numbers right here, and then you take each of those numbers divided by the price I gave you. Mm-hmm. Do you follow that?
Yeah.
Okay. Just make sure you see it.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Yeah, because this is just this, and this is just this, and then I'm just having you fill in one more column there. You just take each of these numbers divided by the price you saw of the product. Yeah.
So I would just do the 200 divided by 10?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just 200 divided by 10, and then the next one divided by 10. And then for the other one, the price was $5. You follow that? Go ahead. That's your marginal utility. This is this, and this is this. So all I'm doing is making it so that you can fill in the marginal utilities.
Okay, and like then you 200. Just divide it by like the price of whatever.
That's right. First you get these numbers in, and these numbers in, and then you divide it by the price you see up here. So in other words, what would you put there?
It's 200.
And then?
280.
No, 80. No. Difference, 80. Okay. And then it rises to?
So wait, is it just 200 and then it goes to 80 because that's the difference?
That's right, because okay. From 0 to 200 was a jump of 200. Okay, from 200 to 280, got it now?
Yeah.
That's why we do this, so that you don't get stuck. How you doing?
So
you're good. You're all right. You're right. You're fine. Take these numbers and look for what was the price of the food.
Oh, okay.
It was $10. So you just take each of these numbers and divide it by $10.
Oh, okay.
And then on this one, what was the price of the product? It was... five, so you just do
the
huh? Don't worry about that yet. Trust me. You fill out this, and then this comes out very... you're just filling in, and then you're looking for where the two match. Okay, look right here. This is this column. So what's a jump from 0 to 200? How much is that jump?
200.
Okay, what's a jump from 200 to 280? No. From 200 to 280 is 80, good. And 280 is 340, good. And then you do it over here. Okay. And then you take each of these numbers. What was the price of food? What was the price of food? Look up here. What was the price of food?
$10.
Good. So then after you've filled in this column and this column, you'll do this column's numbers, each of them divided by 10. And over here, you'll do this column's numbers divided by the price of drink, which was, you follow it? Good. You're all good. Go ahead.
Why do we want them to equal? Is that just like a fact, or is
it's
some
what
reason?
We know that if you had more pleasure from one thing than another thing that you and you like them both, wouldn't you try to find a way to balance the two out? You're getting so much pleasure out of one thing, but you really like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you're like, if you're a restaurant, well, no, if you're like, you know, like at a restaurant and you got food and drink, you really like the drinks, but you're getting a lot more pleasure out of the food than you are out of the drinks. Wouldn't you want to kind of back off the food and get another drink instead? We know that people try to find a way to balance their pleasures based on scale by the prices that you have to pay for things. You follow, go ahead. Okay, and now all you did in this one, damn you, right, small woman. Okay, you just filled in these numbers again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now.
Now we figure out.
Look at consumer equilibrium. Yeah, which pair of these numbers are the closest? Very good. So how much food is this person going to buy?
Two.
Very good. Now, why is that?
Because they're the closest together.
To consumer equilibrium. Mm-hmm. Very good. I am impressed. You're not going to major in engineering. You're going to be an economist. You know, by the way, you do know there's a new field called financial economics engineering. Oh, yeah. And that was, I've been teaching some of the courses to get those kids ready for that. It is serious math. I mean, PhD math. It is cool stuff. Financial economics engineering. Traders don't make any decisions anymore. The financial economics engineers make the decisions. We write programs so that the decisions are made by stochastic partial differential equations, and the traders are just told what to do. They don't do anything except execute what we tell them to. Because stock, bonds, options, all that, they're nothing but mathematical phenomena. They follow the same rules of nature as engineering, that mechanical things do, the same equations. So, you know, they're really, it was like there was a religion. Oh, we have to know these soft. No, it's not. It's just engineering. Know what the right answer is instead of what some market maker or some guru says. Not specifically for those. We can do anything with them. We can do anything that has a value.
I thought you couldn't time the market.
No, you can't time it. Do you know what the best way is to predict the future? Do you know?
Yes.
No, you create it. We can look into the future now, remember?
Well, I don't remember.
We create it.
We talked about that, but I don't understand how someone can see the future.
We can.
2 seconds earlier.
No, it's not 2 seconds. We're only 180 microseconds now. We'll get better.
So basically, he's getting the news feed before everyone else?
No, he's not getting the news feed. He just knows what's going to happen. Because the future, no. Oh, well, yeah, it is, actually. Technically, that's front-running. But our government's so weak anymore, it can't stop it. And it's just kind of fun to do.
Yeah,
you can't technically, but then again, you can't do a lot of things that you probably do, right? Huh? You got it? Very good. And do you know why? Because that's where the consumer gets the most out of each unit, each good based on its price. That's consumer equilibrium. The consumer, based on the prices, and the prices are different, the consumer is getting the most he can out of his combination and the money he has available. See, because suppose that he decided, oh, I just want to buy one food and 8 drinks. Well, he's going to get so much more pleasure based on price out of the drinks than he is out of the food. Why wouldn't he back off the drinks and buy some more food? I mean, he could get a lot more pleasure. See how if he bought a little more food, he'd get a lot more pleasure? Okay, see, that's the idea. That's consumer equilibrium. How are you doing? Okay, so now all you do here is just fill in what you saw up here. Okay, for 0, you put in, well, you didn't, it's not really there, but for 1, look here. There's 1.
20 and 8 right there is a 6.
Mm-hmm. You just fill in those numbers. I'm having you do the same thing over and over again. How you doing?
Is this how much it costs?
No, that's each of these divided by its price. How much was drink? How much were drinks?
$5.
Okay, so each of these you just divide by $5. 90 divided by 5, it's not 9. You want another sheet?
Yeah, so
how you doing? Okay, now, let's finish you up. Let's get this done. Remember, the consumer equilibrium is where the marginal utility scale by price are the same, or the closest. Where do you see that here?
Six, but
That would be 10 and 8. But the next one would be 6 and 14. That's too far apart. So your 2 and 6 is probably your right. So the closest this person can get, based on the income and the prices, is 2 foods and 6 drinks. Because that's the closest he can get to consumer equilibrium. I just told you what to write there, so write it.
Write it there?
I said explain.
Oh.
Oh, damn. I'm sorry.
How much it is per...
She had a question.
Yeah.
What does this represent?
That represents the extra enjoyment you get out of the last one of those based on its price. Now, if you look, suppose...
Based
off
of joy?
Yeah, joy.
Isn't it just like...
Your price-adjusted joy. Look, suppose the person got 4 foods and 2 drinks. He'd be getting a hell of a lot more pleasure out of the drinks than he was out of the food.
Why? This is joy?
Joy scaled by the price. In other words, based on the price, he is getting a whole lot more happiness out of his drinks than he is out of his food. So why wouldn't he...
How much does they cost us?
Well, why doesn't he just back off some of that drink? See, if he backs off the drink, he's still getting good out of the drink, but he's also getting more good. He's still getting a lot out of the... And eventually, he gets to the point where that's as close as he's going to get to the two joys, price-adjusted joys, being about the same. Because if he decides, well, I'm going to just get five foods and no drinks, that's a terrible deal.
Okay.
But even if he gets four foods and two drinks, those two drinks, oh man, I really love those.
So are we supposed to add these together?
No, just look at them. Consumer equilibrium is where the marginal utilities scale by price are equal to each other. See, you're not going to get perfect. You see, in the real world, you're never going to find the perfect sweet. Oh man, I got exactly the right amount of everything. But you're going to get close. And consumers tend to try to move as close as they can to the equilibrium. Hang on here. Give me a second. No, no, that's okay. He doesn't like me anyway. Oh, no. That's close enough. It's essentially, you're as close as this consumer, by doing this, is as close as he can get to his best choices. It's consumer equilibrium. Yeah. That's basically what you're doing. Okay. Let's look at here. Okay, you got everything set up. So now let's look at it. Suppose this guy got four foods and two drinks. He's not getting a whole lot out of the food, is he? And he's getting a lot out of the drinks. Well, if he backs off his food, he gets more out of the food if he doesn't eat as much. He's losing some of his pleasure from the drinks, but every time he backs off a little bit, he's getting closer to these two numbers being equal to each other, where he's got the balance. Which one is the closest to being where he's getting the best balance? Good.
2, 8, and 16.
Just say 2 and 6. Two foods and 6 drinks brings him, that's his best choice, because that's the closest he can get to consumer equilibrium.
So that's his optimum.
That's his optimum. Now, you know, in the real world, you're not going to have perfect. In theory, yeah, they go exactly to the exact where the two are equal, where these two are equal. But in the real world, like this one, now he's not going to get them equal to each other. But if he says, well, I'm going to get 3 and give up a drink, well, that's not a good idea, because he goes farther away from where the two are equal to each other, where he's got the best balance based on prices. You follow?
Yep.
Okay, did you follow that? What I need you to do is take each of these numbers. That's right. Good. And you just go on down the line dividing each of these by... Wait. What are you doing here? No. You got yourself in a world of mess. You want to erase these numbers. Get rid of these numbers. I want you to get rid of those numbers. Okay. Erase all of those numbers. All of those. Now let's erase all of those. Okay, now let's start over again. How much extra do you get in going from 0 to 200?
Oh, she's not a lifeguard.
Just 200.
Good. Write down 200. Now, how much extra do you get going from 200 to 280?
80.
Good. From 280 to 340. Now, do that here. Do the same thing. Do that there. And then do the same thing on this column. Okay? And once you've gotten these numbers, divide each one by the $10 price. And once you've got each of these numbers, divide each of these numbers by the $5 price of a drink. Okay? How are we doing? Okay, so now you're at the end of your game. You got it. And now the only
reason... And I was going to say it's because it's closer... It's
closest to...
Right.
To what?
It's closest to the...
Okay.
It's closer to consumption.
Consumer equilibrium.
It's so close in numbers that I can go up on it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So basically, I mean, this isn't perfect. It's not, they're not equal to each other like theory. But in the real world, this would be the closest this person would get to having the perfect balance. And so say this is the closest this person can get to consumer equilibrium. That's all you say. That's all you write there, and that's the end of it. Okay, why don't we take a break now for a little bit? for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and finish up for the night. The last part of this lecture tonight has to do with something about demand curves. You see this demand curve? There are actually two things going on in a demand curve. The most important thing that's going on is that as the price of a good or service rises, the law of demand says that consumers will consume a lesser quantity of it. Because as the price goes up, they will move to other goods. That's substitution. So the dominant, almost always, the dominant effect, the effect that is behind the law of demand is called the substitution effect. But there's another effect, which is usually pretty small, but sometimes it's not. That effect is called the income effect. You see, because when the price of a good rises, you'll probably move to a greater or lesser extent away from it, just because you can find something else to buy with it. But there's also this thing that you're actually getting your income hurt. What you have is disposable income. Once that price rises, is less because you're still going to buy some of it. And the fact that you're still going to buy some of it means that your income has, your purchasing power for other products has been diminished. So look at this here. The price went from P1 to P2. And so people bought less of this product, but they still bought some of it. Now, if this had been a highly priced inelastic product, they would have bought only a little bit less of it. If it was highly priced elastic, they would have bought a lot less of it, but they were still buying it. So even at that higher price, they bought it. So they had less money for other things that they could have bought. Now, here's the odd thing. Here is a demand curve that has just the substitution effect in it. So when the price went up from P1 to P2, the quantity demanded went down because of the substitution effect. But if this is a normal or a luxury good, when your income goes down, you will buy less of the product because your income is down. So what will happen is that at that higher price, the income effect will reinforce. So you'll actually buy even less with the substitution and the income effects together. So your actual demand curve won't be quite as looking like that, because it's your original consumption and this final, your demand curve is more elastic. I'm going to do this again because this is confusing as hell the first time you see it, probably. Do you see this, though? The thing, though, is that when prices go up, okay, the price was here. This is how much you wanted. But when the price went up, the first thing you're going to do is say, I'm going to buy something else. So you back off to here. But I still am buying this, and my income is hurt because I'm still buying it. So because my income is hurt, I back off to here. So my final quantity demanded at the higher price is up here. So the actual demand curve that I draw is more elastic than the demand curve with just the substitution effect. Let me show you one. That was a normal good. Let me show you how powerful it is with a luxury good. Just to reinforce this point. Here's a substitution demand curve. Just a substitution effect. Now the price starts at P1 and your quantity demanded is, with the substitution effect, is QD1. Nothing big about that. Okay, so the price goes up. Your substitution effect, you want to say, no, I don't want as much of that because I can find something else. But this is a luxury good. When your income goes down, just like when it goes up, you buy a lot more of it. When your income goes down, you buy a lot less of it. So by the time the income effect takes its toll, the quantity demanded has dropped hugely. The substitution effect and the income effect running together cause you to go clear down to here. So in other words, the actual demand curve we see for luxury goods, the one with the demand substitution and income effects taken together, the demand curve we see is very elastic for luxury products because the income effect works very strongly with luxury goods, up and down. So with normal and luxury goods, the income effect reinforces the substitution effect. Again, with normal and luxury goods, the income effect reinforces the substitution effect. And the two taken together make demand curves more elastic than they would be with just the substitution effect. Now, here's the weird thing. Here's a demand curve. Looks like the other ones. Just a substitution effect demand curve. I'm going to do the P1, P2. Price goes up. Quantity demanded goes down. With just the substitution effect, same as with all products. The substitution effect actually doesn't change very much with products. Do you remember what I said? What is unusual about inferior goods? As your income goes up, you buy less of them. Your income goes down, you buy more of them. That's how inferior goods work, remember? Well, that would mean that with this product, if this is an inferior good, when the price went up, your disposable income was hurt. But when disposable income is hurt, you buy more of this product. The substitution effect, the income effect acts against the substitution effect. So that you end up, at the end, at the higher price, actually buying more than you would have if it had just been the substitution effect working. So in other words, with inferior goods, the demand curve, with both of the effects taken into account, the demand curve that we actually see makes inferior goods have more inelastic demand curves. Picture. This effect, in a few rare cases, can be so powerful. Here's your demand curve substitution effect. Price goes up, you move away from that product by the substitution effect. That's always going to happen. That's the law of demand. But with these products, Okay? You backed away from the product because of the substitution effect, the law of demand. But this is an inferior good. So when the price went up, your income was hurt. And when your income goes down, you buy more of this product because this is an inferior good. If this is a product that is a lot, means a lot to you, it is central to your income, the income effect can actually be so powerful that it actually pulls you to a higher final demand curve. And so you see an upward sloping demand curve.